What's up, guys? Kevin Estella here with Fieldcraft Survival. I want to recognize some of our sponsors that make this podcast you're about to hear possible. First one is Sig Sauer. Sig Sauer is the leading name in the United States when it comes to firearms and training. Solid folks at the Sig Sauer Academy. I don't think they get enough credit. These dudes are awesome. These gals are awesome because let's not forget Hannah Billadoo, who's a total badass chica. She's over there along with all my good buddies from the Sig Sauer Academy. Guys, Sig makes some fantastic pistols. I've been playing around lately with the Sig M400 Tread, and that AR-15 platform, I mean, it's got great fit and finish, super accurate. I've let a bunch of students try it in courses. Very, very pleased with it, and I've never had an issue, knock on wood. The other gun that is one of my favorites that I travel with a lot is the Sig 365. The Sig 365 is a fantastic firearm in that it's a striker-fired pistol. That pistol is one that you can change into the small configuration or the large configuration, so the standard or the XL. You can go from a 10-round mag to a 15-round mag. You can do a lot with the 365 XL. And you can also put a weapon light on it, like the TLR 7 sub, making it a great backwoods gun. So check that one out if you get a chance. And like I said, check out the Sig Sauer Academy. It's up in Epping, New Hampshire. If you go up there, stay at the Exeter Inn, eat at Goody Cole's, swing over to Kittery, go shopping over there. You can make a whole vacation out of going to the Sig Academy. And I'm excited to be up there this September. I'll be teaching modern survival skills September 9th, which that class as of this recording is over halfway filled, and it will be a great time being up there for the first time as an instructor at the school where I train 20 something times. So really excited to be back up there. The other podcast sponsor I want to recognize is Vertex. Vertex has been in the game for a long time. I mean, I remember wearing Vertex pants at the Wilderness Learning Center in the early 2010s. And, you know, I still have Vertex pistol magazine pouches that I use when I go to the range just to keep all my stuff organized. And a bunch of the folks here carry various firearms in Vertex bags, which are designed to, you know, carry short barreled rifles or pistol caliber carbines or pistols with suppressors on them. So guys, please check out vertex.com. They've got a whole line of clothing that, like I said, I've worn for many years. It's tough as nails. I still have a pair of Vertex pants that I wore on a pilot TV show that I was on back in like 2016, which, you know, required me to hike through the desert like 28 miles over 3 days. And I mean, I was dragging those pants over rocks and through briars and all sorts of crap. I still have pine sap in those pants from that trip. And yeah, they're lasting. So guys, check out Vertex when you get a chance. That's V-E-R-T-X. And see all the stuff that they have to offer. The last thing I'm going to say is please check out the classes that we have coming up. We are training all across the country. I will be in New Hampshire. I'm going to be in Connecticut. I'm going to be back in Utah. I'll be all over. So if you're looking for survival training, check it out. You can see where I'm going to be. And of course, I'm based here in North Carolina at our fire base out here. So please check us out in Aberdeen. If you know anyone in the Fayetteville area, Charlotte, we're less than 2 hours away. So come and check us out. All right, guys, it is time to get to this podcast. So here we go. Hey, guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I am your host, Kevin Estella. I'm joined with my co-host for this episode. It is Jerry Young. And you might be wondering, or you're saying to yourself, like, what? Whoa, hold on, wait. Normally, we've heard Kevin and Jerry. They've been on the podcast, different sides of the microphone. But Jerry and I are on the same microphone. We're not holding each other's pockets. That's like a... I think our guests eventually will tell us that that's more of like a jailhouse thing. Jerry and I don't do that. But Jerry and I are on one side of the table, and we've got two very distinguished gentlemen to the other side of the table, which I have to say, since you are our first distinguished guests here, we do have a fine Rubbermaid bucket of snacks over there. I'd highly encourage you to grab some peanut M&Ms or gummies or something like that.
Yeah, Altoids over there. Like, yeah, that's good eating.
You know, when we're talking this close to the microphone, it's important that we remain intimate and friendly. Yeah. So, guys, this podcast is going to be an interesting one because we got four people in the podcast room. It might get a little bit of confusing, but you probably know my voice. You probably know Jerry's voice, but I want to introduce you to BC and Ski. They run the Disruptors podcast. They've been good friends for a very long time. This is the first time we've actually met. We're just BSing here at the Fieldcraft Survival North Carolina Firebase. That's a mouthful. So we're just going to talk about a whole bunch of stuff. And I kind of pulled them into the podcast room, and I kind of had to separate Jerry from them because they're all cops. And, you know, here I am, the outsider. I'm just going to run this show. But guys, welcome.
Thanks, man.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, you got it. So where the heck do we begin? How did we meet?
So you and I met back when this is BC, by the way, so you'll recognize my voice is very distinct and different from Ski's. But you and I met back when I first jumped on Instagram only a few years ago when my side gig was writing with Skillset Magazine. And so I started following your account, and like I was saying earlier, you're like this like souped up Boy Scout. Like you're just putting all these like snare traps out and posting videos that were just interesting to me. I bought your book and started, you know, just reading the book and just thought, man, this dude's cool. And what I loved at that time about Instagram was just you could just message people. And you were actually cool. You messaged me back. We started chatting. And I think that you had basically said something to the effect of, I got an idea for an article about Rambo and like whether he's legit. And I was like, yeah. Like, so is Rambo legit or full of shit? And you're basically like, yeah, that's it. And we pitched it over to Jason Swar, who was the editor. I think within that afternoon, he sealed the deal like, yes, write this article. And it took off from there.
Yeah, that article was a blast. And as you can see in the podcast studio, I got those McFarlane Rambo toys that, you know, I'm dying to play with them. Like Jerry and I were just talking about G.I. Joes and like the new ones that are out. But yeah, that article was a fun one because back in 2015, I went to British Columbia and, you know, had a chance to use a Newt Martin MC2, which is basically like his version of the Lyle First Blood. I got a chance to like take the green cord wrap off the handle and make traps with it and make pitchwood fires and stuff like that. And that I forgot that was for Skillset Magazine. That was a fun article. So yeah, we just started talking. I was a guest on your podcast. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I got you connected with Jerry. And mm-hmm. how did you guys eventually talk?
Just old school, like through a telephone call. It was like, I sent you a text. I think it was like, hey, are you available to talk today or something? I think, or you said, yeah, I can call you a little bit later. I think maybe an hour and a half we talked or something that day. So it was good. It was, you know, Jerry squared away. We started telling some stories back and forth. He starts kind of throwing out his history with, if I can talk a little bit, just in general, like about like the drug background. And then we immediately clicked and I was telling him, I was like, well, Ski and I, that's our backgrounds, like drug work, gang work. I've done homicide work. Ski's done training, simulations. And you were talking about your background, like how they just threw you in. Like, oh, yeah, you don't know much about drugs. Here, go buy some.
Here, go buy some crack. Can you show me what crack looked like? Because I don't have a clue what I'm going to buy.
So you're like, sir, can I procure some crack cocaine for you for
$20? Crack cocaine I could smoke later.
Can you talk about the first time you had to buy or no?
Oh, yeah. So the first time they sent me out to buy, literally, I had to go to the sergeant. And I'm like, Sarge, I got a question. He's like, are you nervous? I'm like, well, yeah, of course I'm nervous. I'm like, but the bigger thing is I honestly don't know what crack looks like. So they show me what crack looks like. And they're like, all right, this is the target you're going after. You're going to go get the buy into the house so you can get a search warrant. And I'm like, okay. So I don't want to let them down. And this is old school, like Kel transmitters and stuff. So they send me in there and they had to send somebody out to get more crack. And I'm sitting in this crack house with this crack whore and she's like cutting cheese up on the stove and literally a rat was running around in there. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to die. I'm like, no, I'm good. Big dip in my mouth. So like I stay in there for like an hour and they're ready to come kick the door in, which I didn't know because I'm like, I'm not, I don't want to fail the first time out. So I'm like, I got to get in there. So like, there it is. I get my $20 bump. And give everybody a heart attack. And I swore to God that they were going to see my heart pounding in my chest the first time I bought. I was scared shitless.
I got to jump. This is Ski jumping in here. So it took over an hour to buy a 20 rock.
Oh, yeah. it was bad. And there was like, it was a drug task force thing. So there was like DEA guys and state parole and everybody. And they were like, what were you doing in there? And I'm like, oh, I just wanted to get the crack.
I was just thinking they clearly didn't have a plan in place. Cause if anybody that we were doing that with was in there longer than about 3 minutes, we would have thought for certain they weren't with us anymore.
Well, I think they knew that it was just, there was only the one female that was in the house. Or maybe they thought something else was going on. And they wanted her up. So they left me hanging out to dry.
Finish cooking her cheese, man.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Or somebody was late with the re-up, I'm assuming, while you were sitting around waiting for 20 rock or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I think they had more coming in. I think they got like a couple eight balls or something that came in, and they ended up hitting the house later. But
yeah, go ahead.
I appreciate the hospitality though, because you know most crack houses would just turn you away if they're dry, but she let you in. She
let me in.
Made you a charcuterie board. Is that how you
say it? An old gas stove that was covered with grease and rodent droppings and everything else.
And you were brand new to the police force.
I had probably been on about a year, but I was in literally a small town department. It was the town I grew up in, Hoosick Falls, where like you worked by yourself. Like we had to share guns, that whole kind of thing. And like, I mean, like the sergeant said to me one day, I'm like, Sarge, I got to go back to Hoosick Falls. He's like, why? And I'm like, I got to bring my gun back. Somebody else needs me. He's like, are you shitting me? And I'm like, no, really, I do. The next day, the DEA guy's like, I know you're not. So when I left Hoosick Falls, I was making $5.90 an hour to be a cop.
Wow.
So the DEA guy like felt bad for me, and he says, I know you can pay me off a little at a time. And he brought me in like a SIG 226 and holsters and magazines and ammunition because he felt bad. He goes, you can't be going back and forth that. Besides, you're carrying a 686 and without a holster appendix when you're out buying drugs.
Crockett and Tubbs. Just jamming in your waistband. Yep. That's good enough, right? But the funny thing, like when you're talking about just going in and buying crack, the movies make it look all high speed, and then you get the stereotypes of like what a drug addict looks like or what a drug dealer looks like. And then you watch enough buys and you develop enough informants and you start understanding it's just day-to-day life. And like there was a source that, you know, Ski and I'll do classes and we'll show training videos or not. I mean, we'll show actual videos and say, hey, this is what's going on. And you can see like a lady that's, you know, 45 years old, pulls up in a convertible, gets out, goes to buy a crack rock, and the dealer opens his hand. And at that time, what guys would do is actually offer the buyer the largest rock. You get to pick out which crack rock you want out of my hand. So maybe I've got like five or six rocks in my hand. And she goes to pick the rock out and bumps his hand and he drops them. And another guy walks up and actually helps him pick the crack rocks up, put them back in his hand so that they can finish the deal. Now, I'm kind of nerdy, like my background in college is like psychology. So I'm like reading all the body language and just going, this is fascinating. Like this woman drives from the suburbs to buy a crack rock, drops the crack rocks, and then they pick them all back up. Everybody works in concert, and then she gets a crack rock and leaves. The same guy that drops the crack rock is also tied into a shooting like 2 or 3 weeks later. So it's like, you know, just depending on the environment, you can have a dealer blow smoke and split someone's head with a bullet, but then 3 weeks before is helping a young suburban lady pick out her crack rock. It's not like the movies.
The thing that always baffled me is how they would store it in their butt, and then they would take it out of their butt, put it in their mouth, and then they would spit it in your hand, and you were supposed to put it in your mouth to walk away. Yeah, well, that never happened. That was not doing that.
So I assume most of the people listening don't get like the inside scoop on these stories, right? But when you do it day in and day out, it just becomes, like BC said, it just becomes everyday life, right? But yeah, that's the perfect picture to paint is that $20 crack rock you're gonna go smoke. First of all, it got cooked in chemicals that nobody knows exactly what's actually cut with. But then it goes right into the sweaty butt crack of the dude that hasn't showered in about 3 weeks. He's going to ride around in his old car, you know, with the leather seats and get that good sweat going. Mm-hmm. AC definitely doesn't work in the car.
It's called from under cheese.
From under cheese. Yeah, it's extra. It looks like earwax, actually. You really want me to paint the picture.
By the way, like normally I would jump in all the time left and right on a podcast, and I would definitely be the one to like try to run things. I'm just going to let you guys fly, and like I might throw in the occasional comment from the peanut gallery, but like I'm staying out of this one. So just keep going.
This is a behind the scenes look at the life of a drug dealer and a drug user. But yeah, they store it in their butt crack or up under their what they call it, the gooch.
Yep.
And it comes out, and only one or two rocks at a time come out, and then it goes to the buyer. The buyer normally either cups it in their hand or they pop it in their mouth and they walk off, and then the cycle continues, right?
Yep. But, yeah. And then you got the other crackheads chasing around because they want to split that $20 rock with you when you're walking away.
100%. Yeah.
So a lot of people out there, if you are a patrol officer and you're listening to this and you're like, well, I don't get to see a whole lot of drug deals. One of the things you can look for in a drug deal like that crack, and crack is kind of on its way out for a lot of areas. A lot of heroin stepped in, pills, Xanax, like, I mean, it's perks, like all that stuff. when you're watching hand-to-hand drug deals, you'll watch, just like I said, like someone pick out a crack rock. So you can watch someone hold their hand out, point, and then take it. Or you'll watch the really smooth dudes who will do like a handshake. They do the money exchange. Some corners are set up, and this is some of the things that Ski and I'll teach, is to watch an area that's actually well organized, and you'll see the stash guy who will have, you know, whatever the drugs are that they're selling inside of a paper chip bag, you know, like a Lay's potato chips or some type of bag like that. It looks like trash on the street. They've got the drugs stashed in there. One guy will collect the money. Two or three guys will be the lookout. So like when you get into, say it's a blood dominated area, so you might have a blood set that operates on the corner or in a hotel, they'll set that little circle up. So if the average officer is watching, or the average citizen, they look and go, oh, it looks like just a few guys walking and talking and shaking hands and stuff. But if you sit there and watch an area for probably more than an hour, you'll see that guy who's posted up, who does nothing but collect the money. He never touches the drugs. The two or three lookouts or four or five lookouts, their heads are on a swivel. It's like one of the things we talk about is like when that chin breaks the shoulder plane. So like if someone's standing naturally, they don't turn their head that way. But when they're posted up and they're the scouts, that's what they're doing constantly. That chin turn, their head turns, their chin breaks that shoulder plane, and they're checking their back, you know, to see if one, their enemy's sneaking up, and then two, if the police are on the prowl. And when you can watch an operation like that and then actually film it and document it and then do multiple arrests, and so then if you end up having to go to trial, you can lay everything out in a courtroom. And prosecutors love it because then they're like, okay, this is actually a criminal organization. And like you and I talked about on the phone call, how Ski and I were lucky enough, and Ski definitely worked on a unit for several years where that's all they did was like the career criminal level. And then the gang units that we were on the street level, same thing. We would just focus on that. And so when you can see that hand to hand and just the science of the body language, who's holding, we hit a unit one time or a blood set where a guy had OCD. Like he actually was obsessive compulsive, and he had to write everything down, but he was so well organized. He had got this set to do just that, to have everybody have an assignment. And he had a hand-drawn map with a legend and a key. And so it had like a blunt that was like burning, you know, he drew in the blunt, and that was who was holding the stash. The money bag was the money guy. The eyeball was the lookout. And then on the side, he would have the, not the government name, not the real name of the guys, but their aliases. So any given day, it would be like, all right, these three dudes are lookouts. This guy's the stash guy. So when we hit his apartment, we go through all this stuff, and it's like a treasure trove of like gang intel. He had to have meticulous notes. So all of the gang history, the codes, everything he wrote out very neatly. Then you get to that legend, and we could actually take the legend or the map he had drawn, overlay it with our surveillance, and say, yeah, exactly what he's the organizer. The guy was like maybe 19 or 20, but was turning it into a business when we were used to just kind of seeing independent dealers and that sort of thing. And then early on, we saw it on the street level, like these guys are getting very organized. But this guy, because of the OCD and just his compulsive to have everything organized, was like the Achilles heel. It's like you don't get to just say you're just selling a crack rock here and there. You're running a multi-level operation. But everyone goes, oh, that's where all the money's made, is drug sales. No, man, like the top of the food chain makes the money, not the bottom, not the street dealer, not the guy who's posting on social media with like $3,000 and he's flashing it. And then you find out that's the front money. Like he's got to get his source, you know, and get his money, and then he might make $100 a day or something. It's not until someone gets up to that food chain, which is what Ski used to work on too.
But yeah, that's that book. There's an article in that book, Freakonomics. It says most drug dealers live with their mom. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea is because like you go to buy a BMW with $50,000 cash, right? Yes. And then they're going to say, well, where'd you get this money? Right. Yes. Like just out of curiosity, like where is this? Like, and they'll follow the paper trail back, and it's like, oh, you paid for it in cash and you work at Best Buy, you know, you know, and then, oh, and then you bought a house with this and that. So they say that most drug dealers live with their mom because they can't get a mortgage. They can't get a bank loan. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So there's that allure that like, hey, if I sell drugs, I'm gonna make a whole bunch of money. It's like, you got to pay someone to make the money and they're going to take a cut and they're going to take a cut and you're not going to live that baller lifestyle until you get up through the ranks, but then you also have to take such high risks, you know?
And it's hard to spend it. Like exactly your point. It's hard to spend that money because people are paying attention. And then the other thing is they always either have a lot of money or a lot of dope. Because the more money they get, the more dope they buy, right? And a lot of times what happens is when they'll run, let's see, from where we're at, they'll run down west to like Texas to their supplier down there, and they'll travel with, you know, enough to buy 3 kilos. And at one point in time, we'll just call it like $28,000 a kilo, right? That's all the money they have. But they're gambling, right? They're going, okay, if we can make it there and we can make it back, we can, you know, how whatever, quadruple this money. But they're playing that game of going, if we get stopped, we lose it all. And normally it's not all their money. They start pooling that money together with other people, right? So if you get hit on an interdiction stop with every last bit of cash you had, you have to come home with your tail between your legs. A, you're on the map now, right? Like now everybody's going to just say, okay, well, you either talked or you didn't. So nobody trusts you, and you owe a whole bunch of people money, right? So yeah, it's a good game when you're on top, but when you're fighting to get to the top, you're making money to spend money, right? So like, you know, if we can buy 1 kilo and then flip it into two, and then that's their game. So they actually never really have a stash of money.
Unless it's weed dealers. Weed dealers always game. Had a lot of different, money on them. That's where game. You got money is a weed house.
100%. Yeah. It is funny because you would think all drug dealers operate the same, but it's not true. Nope. Right? There's a very distinct difference in the weed game or the cocaine game, like to your point. So
it's like we talked about when people step on products. You know, like you hear that term all the time. So people are like, you know, you get in the coke gaming, and coke is still big now. Like, while crack seems to like be dying out in some of like gang areas, powder cocaine is strong. So, but you can take a key of coke, powder coke, cut it with another agent or some type of substance, and triple your money or double your money. Right? You end up now seeing a lot of people pushing coke, and we're seeing overdoses, like lethal overdoses. And people that run in that cocaine circle are like, nah, they don't do heroin, so my buddy shouldn't have overdosed. You're like, yeah, but coke is now being cut. Like it used to be cut with certain agents. Like now it's being cut with fentanyl or fentanyl, because I'm in the South, I'm like fentanyl. But it's fentanyl. but it's being cut with that. And so what's happening now is people are overdosing on that when they're snorting coke. And then the families or the relatives are like, no, you just did powder coke. And now we see that. Now, with the lethal overdoses of people shooting heroin with fentanyl, a lot of people are wondering, like, well, heroin's so deadly now, everyone's just going to stop using it.
No.
No, exactly, right? We know that. You and I know that. Skinny knows that. Like, the secret is, like, when I've talked to a lot of citizens and have to explain, the drive in overdoses comes from people chasing that high. And so now when someone does have, so, you know, we call them a hot batch, like whoever's selling this heroin is actually causing people to lethal overdose. Well, now everybody puts a text out like so-and-so OD'd, here's the plug or here's the supplier, get in touch with this person. He's got that fire. He's got that good heroin. So people are chasing the heroin that's actually causing the overdoses. And now your overdoses go up. And for the average citizen or even someone who has a family member who's battling addiction, they can't understand that. They're like, oh, well, heroin would kill you, so you will stop it. And it's the opposite. And then now you've got Narcan out there. So Narcan is causing people to survive one overdose. So normally, you know, someone would OD and that lethal overdose would count as one overdose. Now you can have 4 or 5 a year because Narcan is saving people. But I don't know that it's always addressing that problem. But that's like the what's on the rise right now. And we're now having people who are actually selling just straight up fentanyl. And so either as a cutting agent or it's hitting the street as just that. And you're like, well, you're pretty much going to code out when you hit it anyway. But people want to chase that high or whatever. It's that part's crazy.
Yeah, but explain how potent fentanyl is.
Well, I mean, you now can Google it. But for the first few years when it was hitting the street, you know, a lot of times we would package and handle drugs in the same way. But I mean, just very, very small amounts, like small granular amounts of it can be lethal. And so you can pull articles now and read about drug units where officers or detectives have actually inhaled just from like a bag, opening a bag. And then you realize, oh, like we're dealing with something that is completely lethal, but the demand for it is so high in the U.S. That's what's causing, you know, cartels to make as much money as they're making pushing it across the border. And people don't fully understand that. And so they look at it and they just go like, well, why is this happening? Why is it going at any level, suburbs, streets? Like, it doesn't matter. It's everywhere. Now I wonder, like, in 5 years, what the next one, you know, what the next round is going to be. And I'm sure someone else, West Coast, probably has already figured that out. And now it's going to move east. At least in the South, usually we're the last ones to kind of hit those epidemics, you know.
So we had a medic on a couple of weeks ago. I'm not sure when this podcast is going to come out, but his name was Sean Barnett, and he was talking about fentanyl exposure. And he said that, like, there have been studies where, like, the I don't know what you call them, not the rhesus monkey. What the hell is it called? Like the subject, like the person who is being tested. Like, what the hell is that person called? It's late at night. Give me a break here.
Yeah. Are you talking about just a test subject?
Yeah, test subject. Yeah, there we go. All right, shut up, guys.
Let me push my glasses up after
yeah,
I said
oh, yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A variable.
Yeah, you can tell it's been a long ass day. All right, so the test subject would put a whole shitload of fentanyl in their hand and nothing would happen. And they said that a lot of these cases where, like, someone touches it and they freak out, they say it's like mind over matter more than anything else, but the inhalation's different, you know? So one of the things I got to ask, because, you know, I mean, there's so many different things that we could talk about here. You know, the average listener might be a cop or may not be a cop. I think one of the common denominators is many people listening might have kids. One of the questions I know someone's going to ask is like, oh my God, is little Johnny doing it? Mm-hmm. So quick question is, if you're a parent or if you are in charge of a bunch of kids, like, what are some of the telltale signs? And maybe this, like, totally deflates, like, the sales. You guys were rolling. Who knows? I don't know. I feel like I'm back in teacher mode right now. But, like, what are the telltale signs, like, these days that kids are either buying, selling, they're involved in gang activity or something? Because a parent might want to know, like, man, little Johnny's running with the kids from the wrong side of the track, you know, that type of thing. So, like, what are some things that parents may not be aware of right now?
Yeah, probably the first sign is if a parent, guardian, grandparent, whoever's in charge of that child has any kind of prescription meds in the house, keep them on lockdown and make sure they understand or know every dose. The reason I say is I had a source years ago, and the same thing, like, when I would develop sources, I would talk to them about life in general, how they got involved in this, like, how to help them out. And he was 15 and started popping oxys. So at that time, oxycodone was pretty big. It was like $30 a pill. And he was like, he and his friends, the logic or lack of logic, but what they thought was, this is something from the government, because they thought the government made all pills. This is from the government, therefore it must be okay, because my grandmother's taking her, my mom's taking her. So they started popping them, and then they were enjoying that high. And then he's like, now you run out of the prescription meds in the house, you start to steal in order to get money at 15 years old to buy pills. So if a parent or guardian is losing track of their pills, it may not be a memory issue. It may be that you've got someone in the house stealing those pills. Obviously, any kind of, we call it like on the nod, which is kind of an older term, but like when people get into oxys or heroin, they start to just zone out. And they really do. It's almost like a semi-conscious or semi-sleep state. If you're starting to see a kid doing that a lot, that's just out of character, start following that. Drug side, other stuff like cocaine is starting to be used by 16, 17, 18-year-olds, like at parties in high school and stuff. So, and then you get into any of the gang aspect. The interesting thing is, like, being in the South, when Ski and I talk about gangs and people are like, well, first, he's got a pretty cool accent, but I've got like a strong Southern accent. So first thing, has anybody ever told you had a cool accent, Ski?
It's a little weird.
I've had people ask me what country Ski's from. I'm like, CUS, but no, when people hear my accent and they're just like, well, what would you know about gangs? Like, gangs are all over the South. And one of the first things we started seeing on patrol is just that 15-year-old with a bandana in his back pocket. So you stop and chop it up with him, like, hey man, you know, what's this all about? And I can pull off a nerd pretty easily. So I would just always push my glasses up, like, hey man, what's with this red bandana thing? And years ago, guys would be like, no, this is a flag. Oh, okay, a flag. And they'd be like, yeah, like the American flag, like this is our flag. Oh, well, who's us? Who's our? Oh, I'm Nine Trey Blood. You know, oh, what does that mean? You know, so like you talked about like being a teacher, it's like the reverse. Like this is the teacher now, this 15-year-old, and they would teach me these things. So then I could go in and I've talked to like church groups. I've talked to big corporations. I've presented at power companies because they've had trucks get shot, you know, in Section 8 housing and stuff. And they want to know these same things, these signs, these symbols. So for parents or family members that are raising kids, the first like huge legitimate like red flag is any kind of bandana that is being treated with respect. In other words, it's being folded a certain way. It's being put on display a certain way. So a parent or grandparent, like in the past, someone will report their child being, you know, missing or runaway juvenile. First thing I would always say is like, if you don't mind, can I just look at where they put their head down? Because not everybody's fortunate enough to have a bedroom, but hey, where do they sleep? Where are their belongings? And they show them and then I go, oh, there we go right there. There's that folded bandana. Like in this case, it may be a red folded bandana with five paisleys on display. So when I say about the paisleys, you look at a bandana, it's got those little paisleys or what looks like a teardrop or a little blood drop. So five is very significant to a certain gang and it all coordinates with that. So it's the same as like a poisonous snake has very specific characteristics, right? Mm-hmm. I don't dig a Mr. No Shoulder, so I don't handle snakes or any of that. But I've been told like diamond-headed snake is bad or whatever, you know. So if you look at a copperhead and you look at a garden snake, or they look different, it's the same thing like in the gang world. Not all gangs are the exact same, but you can look at those signs and symbols. A parent or a grandparent or someone can look at something as simple as a notebook or a screensaver for their phone. If they're fortunate enough to have a smartphone or something like that, a simple screensaver with something as innocuous as a five-pointed red star, flames on the star, and maybe blood drops, you know, like it's drawn on or some type of graphic, can very easily be an East Coast blood set. Or it may be something like a six-pointed star. It looks like the Star of David. Could be gangster disciples. So there's like all these kind of signs and symbols. So in the past, I've had people take pictures and text them to me. Hey, what does this mean? We're looking for a runaway juvenile and their whole bedroom is nothing but six-pointed stars, wings, and pitchforks. And then you can narrow it down that way.
So I got to ask this because like obviously when I was a teacher, we talked about like, okay, dress code, kids might be wearing certain gang colors. And I mean, let's put it this way. A lot of teachers, I mean, if the average teacher, your history teacher, your math teacher is aware of what a gang should look like, you would think that a gang would want to evolve to be either more discreet, or maybe they would just say the hell with it. We're going to be more blatant and obvious. Like how have the telltale signs changed over time? Like have they gone underground more? Or are they trying to blend in saying, oh, we're just fans of the sports team, or, you know, that's why we all wear this jersey. Like how have they changed? Cause it seems like the bandana thing's been around since like the freaking Sharks and the Jets. You know what I mean? Like right. we're going to do a switchblade fight.
Yeah. I don't think it actually changes a whole lot. It ebbs and flows, but like going back to your point there, all the way back to the Sharks and the Jets, there's days that they get specific orders, depending on the beef they have going on in the community with other gang sets. And it just really depends on who they're at war with, right? So gang members are always at war with somebody, a rival gang, a rival drug dealer, whatever it may be. And depending on the day of the week or what they have going on really determines how they posture, right? And their dress is a lot of their posture. A brown flag, depending on what type of gang you're in, that's a war flag. Right. And the rules change a little bit here and there, but at least where we were operating, if you saw a set out on the block and you saw six, seven brown flags, there was going to be a shooting that night indefinitely, right? Then there's the, you know, we come in, we do our thing from the law enforcement side. We put a lot of heat on, you know, one of these gangs, and maybe we do a bunch of surveillance and we lock a bunch of their guys up for, you know, just felony drug charges or whatever. Then the shot callers go, hey, little too much heat on the block right now. Everybody's getting picked off. We're not making money. Let's go a little more discreet. Let's go a little more low key, you know, still represent your block, your hood, your gang, whatever that is. But we need to change our tactics up a little bit. But over time, you'll see it ebbs and flows, right? You'll see the flags for a while, and then all of a sudden you're like, man, it's been a while since we've seen a flag, right? Then the beads will come out, right? The same thing as the flags, but they'll do all sorts of different designs with the beads. They'll do all sorts of different, you know, bead count depending on what set they're repping or what who they're associated or affiliated with. And you'll know just by their beads, right? Then it can get very discreet, you know, let's take the flags off, let's take the beads off. But just check how they lace their shoes, right? Are they skipping a couple eyes? Are they only hitting 5 eye holes? Are they hitting 6 eye holes, depending on who they're representing? And we dealt mostly a lot of Bloods in the area we worked here in the South. But you have the Crips as well. And then there's a ton of Hispanic gangs in the mix, but a lot of our focus was Bloods and Crips. So you'd see a variation of 5 and 6, right? That kind of represents their nations. And when you go back through the history of the gangs and all that, and that's how you can really dial in on them. You know, if somebody's dressed in plain clothes, there's always going to be something that indicates who they're with, whether it's, again, the way their shoes are tied or once they start tatting themselves, that's the best because it's wide open,
nice,
right?
Nice burn.
Yeah, dog yeah. Paw the dog arms. The dog paws were there for a long while, and then they kind of phased out, and then I don't know.
Yeah, tell them about dog paws.
Dog paws, the branding, right? It's the mark for Bloods, right? And it goes all the way back up to, gosh, I don't want to mess up my history though, but it goes all the way back up to 93, Rikers Island, mm-hmm. right? It was the 9 Trey Bloods that mm-hmm. really got the dog paws going, and that was their mark. And it was just a 3. It was a dog paw. It looked yeah. like a dog paw, but it was a brand of 3. And they'd usually use, almost ceremonial how they got it, but they would usually use like the end of a shotgun. Maybe they'd light it with a lighter, a car lighter you would see. But, you know.
Now we're really dating ourselves, car lighters.
Yeah, exactly. Get them yeah, anymore. Exactly. I want an old truck with a car lighter at this point in my life, but I digress. No, but they would do it ceremonial, but they would get their paws and that was their rite of passage. And then they'd get jumped in and there's a whole ceremony that goes behind it. And I'll let BC dive into that a little bit more, but, that's their brand. And once it's there, right? And you know, so it doesn't matter how they're dressing. And in the summertime, you have your standard, you know, your black shorts and your white tank top, so you can see them all, right? And then what was really cool is when somebody gets excommunicated from the gang, they get their fourth paw, right? If mm-hmm. they get their fourth paw, you know they're no longer part of that set. Those are the guys as police officers that you want to key in on, especially if it's fresh because they get all nasty, they get infected, mm-hmm. they get scabbed up. You want to go talk to that guy because he's mad at the people.
He's a little disgruntled.
He's mad and he's going to start talking, right? So, but yeah, I get off track here because we, like you said, we can talk for hours on this, but.
So part of the thing that you guys do, and maybe I'm wrong, but, and I don't want to give too much away, but you are teaching like a gang awareness almost to civilians, right? Or is that what you're trying to head into?
Yeah. And BC's done a ton of this and we've actually started talking about expanding it, not hyper-focused on gangs, but actually looking at the criminal underworld and teaching it to civilians, right? Because we have all these people that are interested in training and, you know, obviously who doesn't love good tactical training? Who doesn't love to buy a new handgun and go take a course or a new AR and take a carbine class or something like that? But where we're missing the mark is really teaching people to understand what that criminal element looks like, right? We can teach situational awareness, right? And people can get really dialed in on that, but let's go deeper on that and what it actually looks like, right? And it's applicable to just so many different professions, right? And for example, BC and I were talking on the way here. If you go to college and you decide you want to get out and you want to be in real estate and you get your real estate license and you get your first client, your first customer, you don't really get to choose where they want to look at houses, right? And you let's just say you grew up and you didn't have to deal with anything rough and you've had a nice sheltered life. And it's not a bad thing. That's not a slight at anybody. But they give you a couple addresses and you go there to meet them and you're there about 20 minutes early. And all of a sudden you realize, I've never seen a neighborhood like this before. Wouldn't it be good for that real estate agent, male or female, to know what they've just walked into?
100%.
Right. And you made the reference to the cable company, right? Or BC did, talking about the cable company. You're out there fixing, you know, Spectrum internet at 12 o'clock at night. You need to know what neighborhood you're in, you know, and it's not just specific to the neighborhood or the bad side of town, but it's knowing what to look for. Right. And that's really where we want to start dialing in, because people love the gang stuff and BC is the gang wizard. But so many questions come from that. And it's like, man, we could really open this up and teach people what your fraudsters look like, what your drug dealers look like, what your run-of-the-mill B&E guys look like, what these groups of kids going around, you know, smash and grab cars or just checking door handles or fishing checks out of the mailbox and just all that stuff. And it's right under our nose all day, every day. And it just, because you're an officer, you're just kind of more keyed in on that stuff because that's what we get paid to do. But this is all information that everybody can know, right? And I think there's just a huge gap there that we can fill. And it just makes us that much stronger as a society to be able to kind of push back against that type of stuff.
Yeah, it also, for a lot of people, helps alleviate the anxiety. So especially in church groups I've talked to, where you got a older generation that's now having to handle their grandkids getting shot. They're in a neighborhood where they're seeing the violence and they don't understand it. And all they understand is they hear words being thrown out. They hear blood, Crip, Latin King, gangster disciple, maniac, Latin disciple, like whatever it is. And it causes the anxiety to go up. And then when you can go in and actually talk about it and show them what the hand signs mean and what everything goes on, it at least allows them to understand, okay, I know what's going on. And even one of the better things is to let them peek behind the curtains a little bit and say, hey, this is actually how a very productive street level unit can operate. And it can be a gang unit, a drug unit, whatever you want to call it. I mean, you can call the unit whatever you want to. But when that unit decides, okay, your neighborhood is going to get fixed and this is how we're going to fix it, we're going to go in and we're going to develop sources. And they're not necessarily like you and I and Ski, we would all talk about like informants and code names and we pay them money. Neighborhoods will provide information to you for free because they want you to get rid of like what I refer to as the hive, that one house or that one location, that trailer, that apartment where people are operating out of freely. So if I can go in and just explain to them a little bit like, hey, this is what it looks like when you've got violence or a gang operating in your area. And these are just a little bit of things we'll do. We will utilize plainclothes units, which means you're going to have people of different genders, different races, different ages, different vehicles. You're not going to know who they are. And they're going to come in there and they're going to do surveillance, but they don't know when to find that crime. The grandmothers looking outside of their window know every day, Friday night, everybody's sitting on a power box. And everybody's either flagged up, meaning, you know, that they maybe have some indicators they're in a gang. Either way, they're up to no good, but they're giving, the neighborhood will give us a window of what I call observable behavior. That's all I need. You give me a day and a time frame, I'll get the unit there to actually do the surveillance so they can go to court. They can testify. They can say, yes, I observed this guy and these are the indicators and he had a weapon and we went in and we detained him. He had the weapon illegally. He's, you know, multi-convicted felon. He's gone. And the more you pick off in the neighborhood, the more it empowers the neighborhood. But just simple education to alleviate some of the anxiety, because right now everything is heightened in that sense.
So two quick questions, and maybe they're quicker questions than they are answers. Are there certain criminal activities that are associated with specific gangs, or is it across the board that, like, say, drug revenue is like the primer and the alternate is burglary and so forth? And then the second thing, so the specific crimes associated with the gangs, the other thing is, how are gangs getting more sophisticated with their capabilities? Like, you know, you would think you know, back in the 90s and in the 80s in New York City, they would do wilding, right? They'd run into a store, trash everything. Yeah. And now people are like, oh my God, these flash mobs. It's like, it's called wilding. It's been around for a long time. Yes. You know, it's just now we're aware to it. What are some of the new things that are coming along because of technology? It seems like social media could clearly play a role in it, but like, is there something that people just aren't aware of yet because, well, I mean, it's just not getting reported. So those two questions, like specific activities and then the way that the gangs have evolved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you bring up the internet side of things, and most people don't know just the other side of like the dark web, right? And with the reach of the internet, right? And like, obviously human trafficking is as big as it gets right now. And that should be a topic on the top of everybody's list, right? Because it's getting so bad. But, you know, we would do operations for like the prostitution stuff, but really it's more human trafficking. But you get on these social media sites and there's a back page is one of the more popular ones. And they just put all their business out there, and they're really good at being able to, you know, put up the VPNs and this and that. So you don't really know where these people are operating out of until you pay the money, you go meet the guy, they walk you to the room, blindfold you, all that stuff. But yeah, it's made it a lot more challenging. And then like on the dark web, there's nothing you can't buy, right? And it's obviously monitored. Right. And I never did those investigations. I've been exposed just enough to know what's out there. But there's a whole nother world. You know, I'm talking about, you know, exposing citizens to the criminal underworld like in the flesh. But there's a whole nother dark web out there that exists that it's terrifying. Right. Absolutely terrifying.
And it's organized.
Yeah. So some of the gangs, like you talked about certain gangs and certain crimes. So drugs are kind of across the board, just an easy way for them to make money. But what we're seeing now is younger guys, and when I say young, like 15 to about 17 or 18, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, they would have been learning that trade, how to package, how to cook crack into Pyrex, how to run that drug operation. Now the younger generation has learned fraud or free bands, you know, mm-hmm. So you'll actually listen to phone calls. And it can be a jail phone call. It can be other recording devices, whatever. And you'll hear the generations, the younger guys complaining and being like, nah, I'm not going to mess with the drug game because I'm going to go get locked up for 5-10 years on drug charges that are easy for them to catch. I go do these free bands and get 30 grand, 50 grand inside of one pop. And I don't get any time because it's a white collar crime. I mean, they can Google all that stuff and see that it's a very easy way to make money, not have a whole, in their mind, not a whole lot of evidence. There are ways to find evidence for the fraud, but that younger generation has learned to make money faster. And you've got some guys that are pushing six figures by the time they're like 20 or 21. So some cities are learning, okay, we need to tap into, are we going to use other federal agencies to help us with these, you know, fraud cases if it reaches the federal level. Other gangs, like you've got some gangs that may still run like extortion rings and that sort of thing, which is still kind of what you started having out in California, on the West Coast, the South, maybe some cities are running it. Not as much like that. Like in other words, like where a gang goes in and tells the corner store, hey, you pay us whatever, $1,000 a month or $1,000 a week and nothing bad is going to happen to your store. And then they're like, no, I don't have any problems with the store. And they're like, oh, okay. And then the next night, all the windows are busted out, you know, or the store clerk gets jumped when he leaves. And then he realizes, oh, I basically got to pay these guys to not victimize me. But you were going to say something.
Yeah, just a specific example of one of the fraud crimes that's really hard to catch. And they've been doing this. This isn't new. They've been doing this for a while. But you'll get a crew of guys jump in a car, they'll go to any city, they'll fish mailboxes for checks, recreate the checks. Somebody will be sitting in a hotel room with a printer. They'll print out the new check. And let's just, for whatever reason, it was always $700-$800 range. It didn't raise too many flags or whatever. They print out that check. They go and find a drug user, right? To cash the check, right? And they're going to say, hey, you print out, you go to the bank, you do your thing, you present your ID, we're going to give you $50 for just to go in and cash this check. The user's not thinking. They're just thinking, oh, we don't have time to do it or whatever. So the user goes in, puts himself on the line. He makes $50. he has to walk back, pay them $750, right? And it's that quick. And they'll do that with hundreds of checks. So that cash flow is crazy. And then it doesn't come back on them, right? Even if the user that's cashing the check gets popped, he's not going to say anything. Because there's a group of dudes that's like, yeah, you come back and tell them anything, we're just going to kill you, right? So the other big thing, because you asked gang-specific stuff, what we're seeing right now is the financial institutions are getting hit hard with ATM burglaries and robberies. And this is coming out of Houston, specific to a gang in Houston, Texas. And what they did is a few guys figured out how to successfully breach these ATMs. And then they started teaching other gang members how to do it. And it's gotten so rampant that it's, you know, if we get something way on the East Coast, it's easy to tie it all the way back to Houston, right? Yeah. It came right from there. And they're teaching them, like literally, like you would go to a fieldcraft class and they'll bring the ATM in and this is where you hook the chain, this is where you hook it on the truck, this is where you hook it on the thing, you're gonna pull the safe right out, you're gonna drag the safe down the road, safe doesn't have an alarm, the alarm's and all this stuff, and they've been very successful at it. You know, banks do their counter work and slow it down a little. And then they go, okay, well, this will be easier. We'll just start attacking the ATM vendors. We'll start jamming the ATMs and we'll start doing surveillance and we'll start just waiting for the tech to show up. We'll just walk up on them and just basically say, hey, get out of the way, right? It's not the tech's money, right? And they're walking away with, you know, a couple $100,000 a lick.
Yeah. So Kevin, this is something we should definitely work into, like personal security with, like, especially even like washing of the checks and stuff. Cause that was huge right before I retired. That's probably made up 90% of my cases. They would just come through and run rampant.
Yeah.
And it is, it was always a runner that you caught and then maybe you'd get back to the person. And then if you got that person, you know,
yeah,
tying them to it.
Yeah.
All right. So you have, you know, a less than desirable witness that's going to point this guy out. I mean, it's not going to hold up in court, but it's something we could teach in personal security, like a little more awareness, yeah, that kind of stuff.
The Felony Lane Gang. Google it. Yep. Look it up.
They crush us.
Coming to a town near you.
Yep. You go to it's either a dog park, a pool, or a playground, because all the soccer moms leave their purses in the car. They smash the window.
Yep.
Cards get run rampant and they're gone in no time.
100%. And they're almost impossible to track.
Yep.
It's crazy.
They're day workers and...
Yep. Absolutely.
So we talked on the phone before this podcast, before you guys showed up today, about the potential of doing a course where we open it up to our Fieldcraft audience. You guys open it up to your podcast audience and it's like, hey, let's do an awareness class. I mean, what would that class look like? Let's rehash that conversation. I mean, we can easily accommodate, you know, 3 dozen people or so here. And it could be, I don't know. I mean, we do 4-hour courses, we do 7-hour courses, 8-hour courses, all the way up to 48 hours. So, I mean, like, how would you see it? Like what would be the main purpose of it when someone shows up here? Like, what are they walking away with?
I'll jump in and NBC, you can follow up. I think the first thing, like kind of like I spoke on a little bit ago, is really deep diving that situational awareness, right? You can touch on the basic fundamentals of situational awareness and stuff, but really understanding those observable characteristics that BC spoke about. And then I think the second part of that is the action item that goes with it. Okay, I'm seeing this, it's unfolding, I've taken the class, I understand what I'm looking at, but now what are my options as a citizen, as a civilian, right? I've been trained in firearms, but just because I'm watching a drug deal at my neighbor's house, does that mean I get to run out with my AR and prone everybody out in the driveway? Probably not a good idea for a lot of different reasons, right? And we can paint that picture of, you know, this just happened in my neighborhood like 3 nights ago. Somebody puts out on social media, hey, my Ring doorbell camera went off at 4:15 in the morning, and I reviewed the video, and there's 4 kids out there, and they're checking door handles, right? Okay. There are some people that would get really excited about that, and they go, oh, I just took that Fieldcraft rifle class, and I got this brand new rifle, and it's in the safe next to my bed. I'm going to run out, and I'm going to show these guys. That's a bad idea. Yeah. Right? And why is that a bad idea? For a lot of different reasons, but the first and foremost right now is one of those kids is likely armed, right? And then we're going back and we're talking about these gang crime trends and stuff like that. Hey, the suburban hero dad does not want to go up against 4 gang members out in the driveway, right? It's going to be a bad situation. And I think where that education comes in is really just deep diving these conversations a little more and making people more aware of what they're actually dealing with and what they're actually looking for and then how to respond to it. And I think that's the biggest things is like everybody wants to be the hero, take things into their own hands, but at what cost, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of people when they come to an event like that, they're going to say, or people who might be on the fence would say, well, I already heard them in a podcast. Like, what else could they possibly show? Well, you guys are listening on a podcast, but there are, I don't know how many thousands of hours of surveillance footage. And, you know, to be able to see things in person and to ask questions in real time and to get answers. And, you know, I mean, you're dealing with subject matter experts. So I'm looking forward to this potential for having a seminar here, you know, and you guys are local, which is a great thing. Now, I think, you know, we're already planned out through a lot of the fall. Maybe we can fit something in between then, but it might be early part of 2024. Are there any places like right now before the seminar, like if someone wanted to go and learn more about like their neighborhood, their like their local community, like, hey, where can I go? Can they just stop a cop and be like, hey, what's going on? Or stop by the police department? Like, cause I mean, yeah. Someone right now is probably like, man, I want to know if people are setting up gang sets and this and that, like,
yeah.
Where can they go to figure it out locally?
Selfishly, they can just contact us directly. Ski will give you the email address. And we also have an Instagram account, Disruptors BC and Ski. We literally will, if someone contacts us and you can send a photo maybe, or you got a question, we'll answer it. But yeah, I mean, you can walk up to an officer, ask the officer a question. It's a great way to start that conversation. And an officer nowadays in the climate we're in now would probably be like hugging the person. Oh, thank you. You're not spitting on me or calling me racial slurs, which is what we all get called. Like, but yeah, they can ask. And then if the officer says, well, I don't have that answer, but I can get it for you. Most departments, especially in a little bit larger cities, have some type of gang unit or gang intel or something, someone that can answer those questions. And if the department's smaller, they may just have like a hard charger who's like, yeah, I work a small agency. We've got some gangs out here, but they just love learning about it. Most officers will at least stop what they're doing and talk and answer questions. But Ski, hit them with that email account because I can't remember it.
I think it's thedisruptors.bc.ski@gmail.com.
That's probably the easiest way, maybe. But yeah, please go talk to your local officers.
And if by chance you screwed up that email, is it just because I got a funny feeling there's a lot of dots in there?
There was a lot of hesitation there.
You know, like, oh, you know, yeah. Just throwing a dot. Was there a niner in there?
There's a niner.
So just go to BC and Ski Disruptors Podcast on Instagram, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Awesome.
And we're only on Instagram because we don't know how to work all the other social media platforms. So kind of old school.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you guys coming in today. You know, I'm excited that there's going to be a possibility. The fact that we're so local now, it just makes sense that we do something together. And obviously, if we can help out in any way, we're going to. So where can people find you otherwise? I mean, obviously, like we're going to be doing this event. Like, you know, I don't think we even covered like your interests. I would say probably like a Red Hot Chili Peppers concert, right?
Yeah,
like,
Ski will definitely be there with his Doc Martens and his flannel shirt around his waist.
Oh, if this was on video, you'd understand that that's a joke. So,
no. Well, I was going to say, if people have questions too about specific things they want to learn, like just send them directly to you and say, hey, will these guys speak on this or design a course on this? Like, that's how all this started, was people mm-hmm. telling me, like, I don't know about gangs. I'm like, well, I can design a course for that. It can be 4 hours, 8 hours. I've done up to 40-hour week long, getting into every different blood set, every different crip set. So whatever questions they have, shoot it to you. Yeah, our background is we worked on two different units, but we love music. So I think you're a Chili Peppers fan. We don't hold it against you, but.
All right, let's just clarify this. Like when I was about 12 years old, that Blood, Sex, Sugar, Magic tape.
Yes.
The cassette tape. Yeah. I think I wore that thing out with my Walkman. Remember those back in the day?
Yeah,
it had the capacity of holding like 8 songs until you had to flip that cassette tape over. These kids these days, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I used to listen to that a lot before I hit puberty and I got taller and not as meatballish.
It's not bad. It's not a bad thing. It's one of those bands I like to make fun of people with, but you're still cool, don't
worry. I mean, it's got Will Ferrell as a drummer. I mean, that's pretty awesome, right? All right, guys. On that note, let's end it here. If you guys want to reach out to BC and Ski, check them out, the Disruptors podcast. They've got a pretty cool podcast. They even had me on as a guest at one point. You guys can check us out here at Fieldcraft, North Carolina. Check out the Utah office if you want. We got a whole bunch of cool courses coming up. Jerry's going to be doing a bunch of personal security here in the fall. He might even be traveling around. Jerry and I will both be doing the defensive shotgun courses. I mean, we got a whole bunch of stuff. We'll get you guys in one of those shotgun courses and run one of those Berettas fast. So, dude, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you all, man.
Just glad to be here.
All right. This has been the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. Thanks for listening.